A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about people living on barges. He knew a couple of folks who did it, including his best friend growing up, an engineer who did the Mongol Rally, and once built a trebuchet with him. That friend lived on a barge in London, said it was functional but confined. He eventually went back to land. But others have reported it's peaceful, you adapt to the swaying. The core question is, how does barge living regulation actually work country by country? Is there any requirement to actually use these things as boats, or can they just stay moored forever? And the aesthetic question, are these necessarily cramped environments, or have people pulled off this housing experiment in something more opulent?
This is one of those questions where the answer splits in completely different directions depending on which country you're in. And the regulatory divergence tells you everything about how different governments think about housing, water, and who gets to claim a piece of either.
Where do we even start?
Let's start with the UK, because that's where Daniel's friend actually lived, and it's the most interesting regulatory mess. In England and Wales, the Canal and River Trust governs most of the inland waterways. They issue two fundamentally different kinds of mooring permits. A residential mooring means you're legally allowed to live aboard full-time, with an official address, council tax obligations, the works. A leisure mooring means you can keep your boat there, you can stay aboard occasionally, but you are not legally permitted to live on it.
How many people are cheerfully ignoring that distinction?
That's the entire story. The Canal and River Trust estimated a few years back that there were somewhere around 5,000 liveaboard boats on their waterways without a residential mooring. These are people on what's called a continuous cruising license. The rule is, you have to move your boat every 14 days to a new place, not just shuffle a few feet down the towpath, actually move to a new locality. If you don't, you're in breach.
It's a game of cat and mouse with a 14-day clock.
And the 14-day rule is genuinely enforced now. The trust has been getting much more aggressive about it since around 2022-2023. They have boat checkers with handheld devices logging locations. If you overstay, you get a warning, then restrictions on your license, then eventually they can seize your boat. It's a slow process, but it's real.
Daniel's friend in London. If he was moored legally, he either had a residential mooring, which are famously scarce, or he was doing the two-week shuffle.
Residential moorings in London are essentially unicorns. There's a waiting list that runs years deep. The Canal and River Trust has something like 25,000 licensed boats on its waterways total, and only a small fraction of those have official residential status. In London specifically, the number of legal residential moorings is maybe a few hundred, while the number of people actually living aboard is in the thousands.
Which means most London barge dwellers are technically not supposed to be there full time. It's an open secret.
It's an open secret that occasionally becomes a closed fist. There have been enforcement crackdowns. Boaters advocacy groups have protested, there's been coverage in The Guardian and the BBC. The tension is between the trust mandate to keep waterways navigable and accessible for all, and the reality that London's housing market has pushed people onto the water as a last resort.
Last resort is doing a lot of work there. Let's talk costs, because the prompt mentions saving money. What does a barge actually cost versus a flat?
Alright, so a decent narrowboat, say 50 to 60 feet, which is the standard for living aboard, you're looking at somewhere between 30 and 80,000 pounds for a used one in reasonable condition. New builds can run well over 100,000. Then you've got the license fee, which for a boat that size is around 1,000 to 1,200 pounds a year. Mooring fees vary wildly. A residential mooring in central London, if you can even get one, might run 8 to 15,000 pounds a year. A leisure mooring further out might be 3 to 5,000. Continuous cruisers pay no mooring fees, but they pay in diesel, time, and anxiety.
The friend who said it was explicitly to save money. If he was continuous cruising and dodging mooring fees, the math checks out. He's paying a license fee, maintenance, and diesel. And that's about it.
Versus London rent, which for a one-bedroom flat is comfortably 1,500 to 2,000 pounds a month, 18 to 24,000 a year. Yeah, the math absolutely checks out, but you're trading money for comfort and legal certainty.
The somewhat confined part. A narrowboat is what, 6'10" wide?
6'10" is the standard. That's the width of the narrow locks on the UK canal system. You're living in a corridor. A 60-foot narrowboat gives you about 350 square feet of interior space, and that's before you subtract the engine room, the bow, the stern. For comparison, a typical London studio flat is about 300 square feet. So you're at studio flat square footage, but stretched into a tube.
Which makes me think the opulent end of this isn't happening on narrowboats. It's happening somewhere else.
That brings us to the Netherlands. Amsterdam is the global capital of houseboat living, and it's a completely different proposition. There are about 2,500 houseboats in Amsterdam, and they are not narrowboats. These are wide-beam vessels, often purpose-built as floating homes, some of them converted barges that are 40, 50 feet wide. The scale is completely different.
40 feet wide is a house.
It is a house. Some of these are multi-story, with roof terraces, full-size kitchens, multiple bedrooms. There are Amsterdam houseboats that sell for over €1 million. The most expensive ones are essentially floating villas.
The regulatory setup.
Amsterdam's system is the polar opposite of the UK's. Mooring permits, Liedplaatsen, are tied to specific locations. You cannot just show up and tie your boat somewhere. Every houseboat location in Amsterdam is mapped, permitted, and has utilities connected. Water, electricity, sewage, sometimes gas. The permits are permanent and they are scarce. The waiting list for a permit is functionally closed. The only way to get one is to buy a boat that already has one or inherit it.
It's not a cheap alternative to housing. It's a premium housing market that happens to float.
And the boats are expected to stay put. There is no cruising requirement. These are immobile homes. Many of them haven't moved in decades. Some of them physically can't move. They're built on concrete hulls, or they've been connected so permanently to shore utilities that casting off would require demolition.
Amsterdam houseboats are effectively a zoning category. They're not boats in any functional sense. They're floating real estate.
The city treats them that way. You pay property tax. You have a street address. Well, a water address. The postcode system includes houseboats. It's fully integrated into the municipal framework.
What about the swaying thing? The prompt mentions you eventually get used to it. Is that real?
It's absolutely real, and there's actual science on it. Your vestibular system adapts. The brain recalibrates its sense of equilibrium over a period of weeks. Some people report that when they go back to land, they experience a kind of reverse swaying sensation. Land sickness, essentially. It's the same phenomenon as sailors getting their land legs back. But on a permanently moored barge in calm water, the movement is so subtle that most people stop noticing it within a month.
Unless a storm comes through.
Unless a storm comes through, or a large vessel passes nearby and sends a wake. Then you're reminded very abruptly that your house is a boat.
Let's go back to the regulatory question, because the prompt also mentions Israel, a listing on Yad 2 for a permanently moored boat in Eilat Harbor. What's the Israeli framework for this?
Israel is a much smaller and more ad hoc liveaboard scene. Eilat is the only place it really exists, because it's the only stretch of Israeli coastline with calm, protected water that isn't also a major commercial port or a nature reserve. The Eilat Marina has a limited number of berths, and some of them are residential. But the regulatory framework is thin. Israel doesn't have a canal and river trust equivalent. The marina is managed by the Eilat Municipality and the Israel Ports Authority, and the rules are basically contractual. You sign a berthing agreement, and whether you can live aboard depends on what that agreement says.
There's no national legislation specifically addressing liveaboard housing.
Israel's housing laws are built around land. The whole country operates on a land lease system. The state owns 93% of the land and leases it out through the Israel Land Authority. Water is a different domain entirely. There's no residential mooring category in Israeli law. What you get in Eilat is a handful of people living on boats in a kind of regulatory gray zone, governed by marina rules that were probably written for yachts and never updated to contemplate full-time residence.
Which brings us to the general principle. Most countries' waterway regulations were written for navigation and commerce, not housing. The liveaboard phenomenon is almost everywhere, a square peg in a round regulatory hole.
And you see the same pattern in France, in Germany, in the United States. France has a well-developed canal system. The Voiries Navigables de France manages something like 8,500 kilometers of waterways. And they do issue residential mooring permits in some locations, but the rules vary by commune. Paris has a significant live-aboard community on the Seine, and the city has been alternately tolerant and hostile depending on the administration. Some boats have been there for decades with formal permits. Others are essentially squatters on the water.
Squatters on the water is a great phrase. What's the enforcement tool? In the UK, it's the 14-day movement rule. What does Paris do?
Paris uses a mix of annual mooring permits and a requirement that boats must be capable of navigation. If your boat can't move under its own power, you're in violation. The city periodically does sweeps. They'll check for valid insurance, valid permits, functional engines. Boats that fail get impounded or towed. But enforcement is inconsistent, and the political calculus around it is fraught. Nobody wants to be the mayor who made 100 people homeless on live television.
The optics of towing someone's home away are terrible.
That's the strategic reality for a lot of liveaboards. Enforcement is expensive, it's politically sensitive, and the people being enforced against tend to be organized. In the UK, the National Bargee Travellers Association is a recognized advocacy group that lobbies, provides legal support, and makes noise when enforcement actions happen. They're effective precisely because they've professionalized the resistance.
Let's talk about the opulent end. You mentioned Amsterdam's million-euro houseboats. Are there examples of people doing this at a luxurious level, not just nice for a boat, but actually opulent?
There's a whole world of high-end floating architecture now. In Amsterdam, there's a development called Waterbert, Water District, where they've built entire floating neighborhoods with modern architectural design, floor-to-ceiling windows, heat pumps drawing from the water, the works. These are not converted barges, their purpose. Built floating homes with concrete hulls and timber frame construction that look like they could be in an architectural magazine.
Which they probably are.
They absolutely are. Dezine and Arch Daily have covered them extensively, but the really extreme examples are in places like Dubai and Miami. Dubai has the floating seahorse villas. These are multi-million dollar floating homes with underwater bedrooms where you can watch fish swim past your window. They're part of a larger artificial archipelago development.
Because why have a house that floats when you can have a house that's half submerged?
The aesthetic logic is, I suppose, if you're going to live on the water, you might as well live in it too. But the practical reality is, these are luxury products for people who already have land-based homes. They're not solving a housing affordability problem. They're solving the problem of, I have too much money and I've run out of interesting things to buy.
What about the middle ground? Not cramped narrowboat, not Dubai underwater villa. Someone who wants a spacious, comfortable floating home that's actually attainable.
The wide-beam canal boat in the UK is probably the sweet spot. These are boats built to the maximum width that the broader canals and rivers can accommodate, typically 10 to 12 feet wide instead of 6 foot 10. That doubles your interior space. A 60-foot wide beam gives you about 600 to 700 square feet, which is a genuine one-bedroom apartment. You can have a full-size sofa, a proper dining table, a bathtub. The trade-off is, you can't navigate the narrow canals. You're restricted to rivers and the wider waterways, which limits where you can go and where you can moor. A decent used wide beam might run 80 to 120,000 pounds. New builds can push 200,000. Mooring is the same problem. Residential moorings for wide beams are even scarcer than for narrow boats because they take up more space. But if you can solve the mooring problem, you can have a comfortable floating home for a fraction of what a comparable apartment would cost.
The friend's experience of functional but confined was partly a choice of vessel. A narrowboat is the cheapest entry point, but it's also the most constrained.
I suspect that's the trade-off most people don't fully appreciate until they're living it. You look at the numbers, 30,000 pounds for a boat versus 200,000 for a flat, and you think you've found a cheat code. Then you spend a winter hauling propane tanks through the rain and realizing your entire home is 6 foot 10 wide and your toilet needs to be pumped out every 3 weeks.
There's a certain romance to it that collides with the reality of waste management.
The romance to pump out ratio is the true metric of liveaboard satisfaction.
That should be on the listing. 3 bedrooms, river view, romance to pump out ratio, favorable.
To be fair, the pump out thing has improved. A lot of modern boats have composting toilets now, which eliminates the need for pump-out stations entirely. And solar panels have transformed the energy situation. 15 years ago, you were running a diesel generator or running your engine to charge batteries. Now, a decent solar array and lithium batteries can keep you powered indefinitely in summer, and with a small backup in winter.
The technology has made it more viable, even if the regulations haven't caught up.
The regulations are the bottleneck everywhere. The physical experience of living aboard has gotten dramatically better. The legal experience has not. In fact, in many places, it's gotten worse, as cities have realized they have unregulated housing stock floating in their waterways and started asking questions about tax revenue and safety codes.
Which is the same impulse that led to the crackdown on short-term rentals. Governments see an unregulated housing market and their first instinct is to regulate it.
The second instinct is to tax it. In the UK, residential moorings are subject to council tax. In Amsterdam, houseboat owners pay property tax. The moment a city recognizes that people are living somewhere full-time, the tax authority wants its cut.
As is tradition.
As is tradition. But there's a legitimate safety question, too. Boats have gas systems, electrical systems, and they're in water. Things go wrong. Carbon monoxide poisoning on boats is a real risk. There have been fatalities in the UK from faulty gas heaters and poorly ventilated engine spaces. The British Marine Federation and the Boat Safety Scheme have been pushing for stricter safety inspections precisely because people are living aboard more and treating boats like permanent homes rather than recreational vehicles.
The regulatory push isn't purely about revenue. There's a genuine public safety dimension.
And the safety standards for a boat that someone sleeps on 365 nights a year should arguably be higher than for a boat someone takes out on weekends in July. But the regulatory frameworks were built for the weekend boater, not the full-time resident. So you get this mismatch where the rules are simultaneously too strict in some ways. The 14-day movement rule doesn't make anyone safer, and too lax in others because the inspection regime wasn't designed for continuous occupancy.
What about the mooring and ILAT scenario from the prompt? Is there any international norm around whether a permanently moored vessel has to be capable of actually sailing?
It varies enormously. In the Netherlands, as I said, many houseboats physically cannot move. In the UK, even residential moorings typically require the boat to be capable of navigation and insured as a vessel. In the US, it depends on the state and the specific water body. Some marinas require you to take your boat out periodically. It's called a cruise out requirement, to prove it's seaworthy. Others don't care as long as you pay your slip fees.
The ILAT situation is probably similar to the US marina model, governed by contract rather than legislation, with rules that vary from one marina to the next.
In ILAT specifically, the marina is a commercial operation. They're renting berths. Whether they allow liveaboards is a business decision, not a legal one. If someone's boat becomes an eyesore or a nuisance, the marina can simply not renew their contract. The lack of formal regulation cuts both ways. It means fewer protections for liveaboards, but also fewer restrictions.
Which brings us back to the broader question. Is barge living a viable housing strategy, or is it a lifestyle choice masquerading as one?
I think it's both, and the balance depends entirely on local conditions. In London, it's a housing market escape valve. The numbers make sense. You can own your home outright for £30,000 to £80,000 and pay a few thousand a year in fees, versus renting forever or taking on a mortgage that'll take 30 years to clear. But you're trading security of tenure for financial freedom. A continuous cruiser can be told to move at any time. A residential mooring can be lost if the mooring operator changes hands or changes policy.
It's cheap for a reason. The discount is compensation for risk.
And in Amsterdam, there's no discount. You're paying a premium for the privilege of living on the water. It's a lifestyle choice, not a financial strategy.
The opulent end. The Dubai underwater bedrooms. The Miami floating mansions. That's not even lifestyle. That's just wealth expressing itself in three dimensions.
Wealth expressing itself in the dimension where fish can watch you sleep.
There's a sentence.
I think there's an interesting middle category that's emerging. Purpose-built floating communities that are designed as affordable housing from the start. There's a project in Copenhagen called Urban Rigger. It's student housing built on floating concrete platforms in the harbor using recycled shipping containers. The units are small but well-designed, and the whole thing is modular and scalable. The idea is that cities with waterfronts and housing shortages can build on the water without the regulatory headaches of converting old barges.
Does it work?
The Copenhagen project has been running since 2016, and it's been successful enough that they've expanded. Similar projects have been proposed in other European cities. The key insight is that building purpose, built floating housing from scratch, lets you comply with building codes, fire safety, accessibility requirements, all the things that converted barges struggle with. You're not trying to retrofit a boat into a house. You're building a house that happens to float.
Which sidesteps the entire regulatory mismatch.
You're not governed by waterway regulations because you're not on a waterway. You're in a harbor basin or a purpose-built floating dock. You're governed by building codes and housing regulations, just with different foundations.
The future of floating housing isn't boats. It's floating buildings.
I think that's right. The barge and narrowboat phenomenon was a creative workaround, people repurposing existing vessels because that's what was available. But the next generation is going to be purpose-built. Floating concrete platforms with modular housing on top, connected to municipal utilities, legally classified as buildings rather than vessels. It's the difference between living in a converted van and living in a tiny house. One is a vehicle you're sleeping in, the other is a home that's small.
The converted van is a great analogy. Same regulatory gray zone, same mix of freedom and precarity, same romance to pump out ratio.
The same trajectory, from ad hoc workaround to formalized product category. 20 years ago, living in a van was a fringe thing. Now there's an entire industry around camper van conversions, and municipalities are figuring out how to regulate them. I think floating homes are on the same curve, just maybe a decade behind.
If someone's listening to this and thinking about doing it, maybe not in London, maybe somewhere else, what's the one thing they should investigate before anything else?
Everything else is secondary. The boat itself, the fit out, the solar panels, the composting toilet, all of that is solvable with money and time. But if you don't have a legal place to put the boat, you don't have a home. You have a floating liability. And legal moorings in desirable locations are scarce almost everywhere. The waiting lists are long, the fees are high, and the rules can change. That's the bottleneck.
You find the parking spot before you buy the car.
You find the parking spot before you buy the car. And you read the fine print on what parking actually means. Are you allowed to be there full time? Is the permit residential or leisure? Can it be revoked? Who owns the mooring? Is it the Canal and River Trust, a private marina, a municipality? Each of those has different incentives and different levels of accountability.
If you're in a country where the regulatory framework is thin, like Israel, you're essentially betting that the gray zone will stay gray.
Which is a bet some people win and some people lose. In Islet, the marina has been relatively stable, and the few liveaboards there have been doing it for years without major issues, but there's no legal guarantee. A change in marina management or municipal policy could upend everything.
The prompt mentions a listing on Yadu for a permanently moored boat in Eilat Harbor. That's presumably someone selling their spot in the gray zone, and the buyer would be inheriting both the boat and the regulatory ambiguity.
That's the thing about gray zones. They're priced accordingly. If that boat were a fully legal residential property with all the protections of land-based housing, it would cost more. The discount is the ambiguity premium, or rather, the ambiguity discount.
Which loops back to the friend's experience. He got the discount, he lived with the confinement, and eventually the math stopped working for him. He reverted to land.
I think that's the typical arc. People do it for a few years, they save money, they have an experience, and then they move on. The people who do it for decades are either deeply committed to the lifestyle, or they're in places like Amsterdam where it's not a compromise. It's just a different kind of house.
Or they're in one of those floating villas with underwater bedrooms, in which case I'm not sure we're having the same conversation.
At that point, you're not living on a barge. You're living in a maritime-themed luxury hotel that you happen to own.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, the Comoros Archipelago briefly became the world's largest producer of ylang 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 essential oil, not because anyone planned it, but because French perfume houses abandoned their Madagascar plantations after independence and the discarded rootstock washed up on the Comorian island of Anjouan and took over the hillsides.
Washed up rootstock accidentally creating a global fragrance monopoly. That's a new one.
So, here's what I'm left with. floating housing is at this inflection point where the old model repurposed boats in regulatory gray zones is slowly giving way to something more formal. Purpose-built floating communities, proper legal frameworks, building codes that acknowledge water as a foundation. But the transition is uneven, and in most places we're still in the gray zone era.
The gray zone era has its own kind of logic. It's accessible precisely because it's unregulated. The moment you formalize everything, you get safety and security, but you also get higher costs and fewer options. There's a trade-off between freedom and protection that runs through every version of this, from the continuous cruiser on the Regent's Canal to the Amsterdam houseboat owner with a permanent permit and a property tax bill.
The question is whether we can find a middle ground. Regulation that protects people without killing the affordability that makes floating homes attractive in the first place. Some of the purpose-built projects in Northern Europe suggest it's possible, but they're still small-scale and heavily subsidized.
That's the thing to watch. If those projects scale, and if cities start treating their waterways as developable land for affordable housing rather than just recreational assets to be preserved, the whole equation changes. We could see floating neighborhoods become a normal part of the housing mix, rather than a quirky alternative.
Something to keep an eye on. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for the fun fact, and for keeping this operation afloat. I will not apologize for that.
I wouldn't expect you to.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com, and if you're enjoying the show, leave us a review wherever you listen. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.